the review session on Wednesday, the 6th of December, and we are open for questions. How many questions will be on the final? Four essays to write three of, and
we have 78 right now.
Approximately 75 to 80 multiple choice. Approximately. Yes. Yes. Now, wait a minute. You're sure you want to share that question with people who weren't there? Because some of these people may not have been privy to that particular question. Well, does everybody else, does anybody mind if people who weren't at that lecture get the question that you all came to class to get? I'm playing. Go ahead.
Provide an example of the relevance that makes interconnection.
Yep. So the question for the essay was describe and explain an example of one. What? One what?
Interconnection.
Yeah. One. Help me out with one. One example of development. Thank you. That was a good word. One example from any place in the lifespan that illustrates the interconnectedness of the three domains. Okay. So, you all got an idea? What do you want to talk about? Which transition or event or experience in the lifespan do you want to talk about, to write about? Puberty. That's a good one. Okay. So how would you describe puberty as involving all three domains and their connectedness with each other? You can pass and kick it to somebody else if you'd like, but okay. So puberty is fundamentally a physiological or biological event. So that's an important part to get in there. And
you have cognitive, you have maturing.
Okay, cognitively you're moving toward what? At about the same time. Formal operational thinking, good. And those two may or may not be really connected. So that's still a research question about whether or not there's any direct connection. But we assume that the brain is changing and that's making the formal operational skills possible. And then what about the psychosocial? More sociable with peers or less, actually, depending on how you're dealing with puberty. But what's going on at about the same time psychosocially? Anybody, anything? Okay. Dealing with identity. And Erickson describes you're dealing with identity because, remember why he says, why identity is the issue? Because of the physiological changes of puberty and the intellectual skills that make it possible to look at hypothetical possibilities. So the combination of the biological change and the cognitive skills is making identity necessary to question identity and possible to question identity. What else is going on about that same time? Remember Sullivan? As you start to go into adolescence, the end of childhood, you're dealing with developing the skills of intimacy, right. Good. And that's a psychosocial development. And it's partly related to the cognitive skills as you become able to be reflective and think about having thoughts and feelings inside you. So you're looking at peers in a different way. Now, how might that be connected to puberty? Okay. Relationships are changing because your body's changing, because you're becoming sexual and mature. You're looking at other people differently and they're looking at you differently, so the transactions that you're having with other people are different. And that's making you question. So that's a cognitive challenge, because people are treating you differently because you've got breast buds now, or a mustache, or whatever it is that's appropriate for whatever your biology is. So people are treating you differently and you're feeling differently about people. That's all psychosocial, and you've got to make sense out of that, and that's the cognitive piece. So that drives the cognitive skills as you try to cope with those. Okay. So what I'm trying to illustrate is that to answer that question, you have to pick an episode or an event or a transition that lets you talk about what's going on in each of the three, and then address the issue of interconnectedness. How are these related to each other? It's not enough to say that things are happening in each of the three. It's how is one driving another, and thinking about how the cognitive changes might be changing your friendships in this case, the psychosocial. So the cognitive is making intimacy possible, and that's changing your relationships. And as you change those relationships, that's getting connected to your physical changes, which are changing your feelings about other people, and that's interfering with or helping the intimacy. So you can talk round and round that triangle of those three domains. The what we'll be looking for in answers is that you touch all three domains and that you talk about how they're related to each other. It doesn't necessarily have to be transactional. You don't have to go through all six possibilities of each affecting each of the others. But the more you can do that, the better. But some transitions, it may not be possible to find, for example, a way in which the cognitive is changing the physical. That one's harder to see in most transitions. But the physical may be connected to the cognitive, because it's giving you, depending on the transition you choose, it's giving you a challenge to make sense out of. So make sure you hit all three and talk about how they're related to each other. And check the website, because it has the examples that I didn't go over in class. There are seven or eight transitions or events, just with each of the domains listed and some of the changes. And then for yourself, think through how those changes are related to each other. It's in the psychosocial domain section of the website. Yeah, that's one of them. The birth of your first child is one of those that I have listed there. Would you make sure they're really there? look. And that essay question, you know, really gets at the heart of what I hope everybody's gone away with from the course, that you can think about each of the domains separately, but you can also think about all three at the same time. And that if people go away from that, from the course with that awareness that all three are involved all the time, then I'll be a happy camper. I'm a happy camper anyway, but I'll be happier. Adrian.
Which different people do we need to have? Bowen, Eric?
Bowen, keep going. I'm just reviewing what you're saying.
Do you want to know Freud?
No, you don't need to know Freud. Erickson,
Keniston,
Sullivan, Bowen, you don't need Montessori.
Okay. No.
I'm sorry?
Marcia.
Not in detail. Marcia did a lot of research based on his interpretation of Erickson, and what he's describing is really Erickson's concepts. So if you know Erickson, and particularly about identity, which is what Marcia was focused on, then you've got it. I'm not likely to ask a question specifically about Marcia. Sternberg, I would be happy to talk about the three or four components of his view of love. It's so hard to find somebody who actually does research on love. But he's good. He also does interesting research on intelligence. Levinson, Kohlberg, Gilligan. Valiant. V-A-I-L-L. They are all important people in the text, and Valiant particularly, Levinson and Valiant, anybody who shows up in two or more of the adult development chapters is fair game for a multiple choice question or two. Valence fun. Mostly his two kinds of research, you don't have to remember this, but one is he's followed the lifespan of alcoholic men and women. And he was here a few years ago and gave a presentation on what happens to alcoholics over the lifespan. You either get sober or get dead. Those are the only two choices. And he then backs that up with the data about what happens if you're an alcoholic when you start. His study, people started in their 30s. And he followed them until they got dead. And if they got sober, they lived longer. The other part of his research that's interesting to me, because I was a subject in it, I am a subject in it. There is a wave of studies of Harvard students that were started when we were freshmen. The first one was started in the 30s, I think, 30s or 40s. And then they continued. And my class was one that they picked a bunch of us from. Studied us for 4 years to see how Harvard screwed us up. And then every once in a while I get a survey of attitudes, a whole big packet of tests to take, and survey instruments. I got one last spring. It was fun. And then they send me copies of the articles that they've written about us.
So for a lifespan developer to be able to be a study subject is fun. The important things from valence research that the text focuses on, if I'm remembering it correctly, the key element for me is that in reporting on the Harvard students, the first waves were rich kids because everybody who went to Harvard was rich in the 30s. They changed that to let me in, but there were others. They diversified. When they first started the study, they expected to find that privileged white males would have far fewer problems than the rest of the population. And the startling conclusion was that everybody has problems, and having money or being white or having privilege doesn't reduce the probability that you'll have problems in your life. And then he went on to describe how people cope with problems, and coping skills make a difference in how well people do with the problems that they're handed in life. Make a note, make sure I cover that next fall, because it's an interesting point. Yeah. So people who have good coping skills, adaptive skills, when they're young, do better through life, regardless of the problems that are handed to you. And people who don't adapt very well have problems that snowball. Everything on this exam will connect to psychosocial. So all the questions will deal with psychosocial, but they may ask you to connect them to cognitive or to biological.
We don't really have to worry about
going back to that. No, you don't have to go back, and there won't be any questions that are just on cognitive development. But you have to know about cognitive development in order to connect it, right? The big ideas, right? Is that all that's left? Just the big ideas? If those are left, we're in good shape.
What personal and social characteristics experiences in early adulthood or early and middle adulthood are most predictive of old age?
Okay, then. Let me see what I intended to write. Is that okay?
What personal and social characteristics and experiences in early and middle adulthood are most predictive of a long, happy, and healthy old?
Oh boy! What experiences and characteristics in early and middle adulthood are most predictive of a long and healthy, happy old age? Good question. And I'll bet the text has some good material on that. Candidates would be flexibility. I just mentioned from valence research, good coping skills. Adaptability. My guess would be a positive attitude, optimism. Having close relationships.
Wouldn't that be like indicative of like
your whole life? Yep. The observation is, wouldn't that be indicative of your whole life?
Sorry?
I'm repeating for the podcast that the observation is that would be the same through your whole life, but particularly in the way we look at adulthood, it's interesting, and the text makes a big deal out of the fact that we can predict a long and happy old age, and that we can predict that fairly early in adulthood. And I think Levinson addresses that, Valent addresses that. Helsen probably. I think her research on women is particularly useful. The what?
The four views of personality development.
The four views of personality development. That's from the text, right?
Yeah.
And we should look at that. You understand them?
No.
Okay. Yeah. Are they a big deal in the text?
Maybe.
Okay. We definitely should look at those. Page 511. Okay. Thank you. I'm blocking on what those are. I could make them up, but I don't want to do that. Talia's got it out. She's reading it. So she's going to talk about it. Oh, that one, yeah. Trait, normative stage, timing of events, and
typological.
Okay. Yeah, you should have thought about those a little bit. But one of the things that's really important is that Erickson's is a normative stage model. He has 8 stages. He said these are the things that are going to happen to you. And these are the issues that you're going to face at each stage, and they're predictable. So the fact that they're predictable, and he thinks they're universal, satisfies the criterion for normative. As he says, everybody's going to go through the same things. Other theories talk more about the things that happen to you and when they happen as important in shaping personality. So they're called timing of events models. Some argue that in the trait models that you have a series of traits and they describe you and they're relatively consistent and you will be the way you are as you age. I'm probably distorting that one. For example, in a trait model, somebody will say that the important thing about your development is that you have a high need for achievement. And that will describe or characterize your development all through your life. And people do research on whether that's true or not. And then the typology models typically say things like, well, there are 4 types of people, or 8 types of people, or 27 types of people, and you get to be one of them, and that governs the way your personality changes and as you mature. There are different ways of thinking about personality and accounting for change across time. And they lead people to have different kinds of concepts and to do different kinds of research. And they're all useful to some extent, depending on what you need a theory for.
Yes. Okay. Everybody knows the answer to that one now, right? Can you make a person more sociable or more emotionally competent than her genetic potential will allow? And the answer is no. Why? You can't alter the genetics. And if you can become more sociable, then that's within your genetic potential. It's the trick question asked in each of the three domains, is to remind you. That there are limits to genetic limits as an explanation for things. How would you determine the genetic limit? That's the difficult one. And the developmental geneticists wrestle with that one regularly. How do you determine what the genetic limit might be? And when you wrestle long enough with that question, you end up forced to give up the notion that genetics causes anything all by itself, and you're forced to think about how genetics work with experience in the environment, because you can't have one without the other. So we stop asking about how much is genetic and how much is, or is this all genetic or is this all environmental, and talk about, well, let's talk about how your genes and the environment conspire and transact with each other to provide the basis for what you become.
What is the connection between infant attachment spot and their partnering in early childhood?
Aha. The connection between attachment style and in infancy and toddlerhood. And so you have the experience of developing attachments that fall into one of several types because of the transactions that your caregivers establish for you. And that attachment style gets carried over into creation of new attachments later, dating in adolescence, for example, and partnering. So the assumption is that, within some limits, but the assumption is to some extent you carry your attachment style that you develop as an infant into the way you create and maintain attachments in adulthood. So if you're a securely attached infant and toddler, then you're likely to expect other people that you're perhaps partnering with to have attachments of the same sort, and you tend not to be anxious or resistant to attachments. But if you have transactions as a child that lead you to be anxious about attachments and not trust the other person to be there for you and to be consistent, then you carry that style into dating and partnering, and you're anxious about what the other person is doing, and you're not comfortable in the attachment process. So that's one piece, that you carry it forward. And then the other part of the question is, how does it, or the related question is, how does it carry it into your parenting when you have children? And the text describes the research that says that people carry their attachment style into their parenting as well, and promote
with their children the same kind of attachment that they developed as infants and toddlers. So there's some continuity there. And some of the research suggests that that's the case across three generations, particularly when you look at mothers, that if you can look at them when they were children and then when they become parents, what they promote with their children, and then when their children grow up and become parents, that there's some evidence that it carries across at least three generations. That raises some interesting speculation, too, if you want to do some research, which is that temperament with a genetic base may be a significant factor in how we create those transactions, that people with different wiring, different constitutions, biologically may promote different kinds of transactions with their parents and later with their children. But that's a piece of research that hasn't gone very far yet. But when you see something going across generations, one of the legitimate speculations is that there might be a biological component in this that's being passed down from mother to child.
They're saying that anxious mothers create anxious kids who then create anxious people.
Yep.
And it just keeps continuing.
And it just keeps going. Yeah. Can you change your attachment style?
With guidance.
Probably, although it depends, I think, to some extent, how much attachment is ingrained in your emotional responses to other people. But the optimistic view, the constructivist view, would be, yes, you can do that. And the process would be becoming aware of it, aware of your style, by analyzing the attachments that you have and the attachment difficulties that you have, and then deliberately working to create different ways of transacting with new people or with the old people, so that you have transactions that are healthier or different. And I just revealed an assumption. I was assuming that if you're attachment style is anxious or resistant, that you would want to become secure, but rejecting the, or just ignoring the possibility that maybe your attachment style is secure and you want to become resistant or anxious. But I suppose that would be a possibility. And that may be actually an interesting situation to look at, because it's possible that you can have a secure attachment style with a parent and get into dating situations that are unhealthy transactions in adolescence, and in the peer attachment realm become anxiously attached with peers, even though in the parent-child relationship you might have been secure. And that would demonstrate that it can change, and it would be changed on the basis of the transactions that you're having. And adolescence might be a significant time to have changes happen, because you're shifting from hierarchical attachments as to somebody older than you to peer attachments. And as you make that shift, those first transactions in adolescence might create new positive potentials or negative potentials. Well, the parallel question is, can you change the parenting style? Can you do something different from what your parents did to you? and the evidence for that is probably that if you deliberately, if you analyze what your parents did to you and what was good and bad about that, and then decide very specifically how you want to parent and why, so that you're changing your view of the parenting process, and stay aware of that as you start to parent and practice having responses that are different from your parents had to you. The optimistic constructivist view is that sure, you can change, you know, the way you parent, or you can overcome what was done to you. And again, I suppose you could learn to be a bad parent even if you had good parents. Theoretically. That would be an interesting research study too. But the sort of general principle here is that across the lifespan, you're having transactions that are encouraging particular kinds of emotional reactions and attachments and ways of relating to people. And you're carrying those forward, but they're not set in stone. That you are continue to have transactions, and you, as you go through adolescence and into adulthood, you develop the ability to think about your own development. That was part of my parting gift to you, that you have the courage to look at your own experience and to reflect on it, and that you have that ability to make sense out of your own development, because then you have the basis for changing the way you transact with people. And a therapist or a counselor has the role of creating transactions with you that will help you understand the results of your experience so far, to understand the transactions that you have with people now, and to make deliberate changes in those as you change your understanding of them. So the emphasis is on the cognitive part of making meaning of your experience, and transactions that are specifically designed to help you change your understanding are therapeutic. They are developmentally facilitating. And that's what counselors do. Right? Yes. Talia says yes. That's what she's here to do. That's what she's learning about. How about Gilligan? How about Gilligan? Gilligan's Island, right. Yeah, well. Carol Gilligan, the other one. One of the others. Carol Gilligan, you may remember from the cognitive unit, the chapters on that, because of her different approach to moral judgment. She worked with Kohlberg. And Kohlberg took Piaget's work on moral judgment and elaborated it and created a series of six stages that's reflective of Piaget's description. And then Gilligan argued that Kohlberg was thinking about a particular kind of morality that she decided was kind of male, and that it ignores relationships as the basis of morality, that it focuses on law and rules, and that she would prefer to think about a relational kind of morality. So she criticized Kohlberg in a friendly way. They worked together for many years. They were on the same faculty. But it's very clearly a different interpretation of morality, and both views are interesting. The text describes fairly nicely the importance of Gilligan's view in women's development, and the importance of the fact that women give high priority to relationships and responsibility in relationships, and make moral judgments on the basis of the impact of behavior on relationships rather than on some abstract morality. Women actually do both, but they're more likely to think about the relational impact of behavior than stereotypic men are. It's not that men don't. There's when you're testing them and they're talking to you about the basis for their judgments, they tend to use different language. So Gilligan talks about adulthood, women in adulthood, making decisions about career in part based on their relationships and their commitments in relationships. She also suggests that women focus more on intimacy than on identity, or on achieving a sense of identity through intimacy. And she disagrees with Erikson's view that first you need an autonomous identity, and then you take that into creating a sense of intimacy. She and Erikson had interesting discussions about that, because Erikson describes in detail the importance of peer relationships, and he's talking, to me it sounds like Sullivan, but he's talking about the importance of relationships in the formation of identity. And I think sometimes when I read what they both wrote, I think they're not hearing each other. As often happens in psychology, everybody thinks that in order to contribute, they have to prove everybody else wrong and disagree with them. So they set up, they misread other people's arguments, and then they say, well, I'm right, when in fact, they're often not hearing each other. It's frustrating part of hanging around psychology and sociology for long enough. You know, why don't you just read and accept and think of it as useful, and then you can combine something with it. You don't have to prove it wrong, because it's probably not provable wrong. But people are not open to other people's ideas as they ought to be. I like Gilligan very much. She was a graduate student when I was an undergraduate, and my mentor was a good friend of hers. So I like her work, and I like her husband even more. He's also a psychologist. Pardon? You should know what the text says about Gilligan. Yeah. Yeah.
What are the changes that occur in a person's relation with family across
adulthood? Across all of adulthood, across the lifespan. How do your relationships with family change? Yep. That's not a half-page answer question. I sometimes use that as a 3 or 4 page essay in one version of this course that's essay-based. How many different ways does your relationship with family change? From being dependent as a child and needing everything to... The emotional attachment is forever. And even if they're not present, you'd like to have family available. Sometimes harder when they're not. But the dependency relationship change, and that's often described as you go from being the dependent one to being the responsible one as those roles shift. you know, as I take care of my mother and make decisions for her or help her make decisions, and she's dependent on me in her old age. That's a typical switch in the parent-child relation. So you go from being the one with no responsibilities as an infant to being the one with a great deal of responsibility. And the text describes the fact that some people get middle age, you get to be the middle of the sandwich, because you may have responsibility for teenagers at the same time you have responsibility for your own parents. So you're between. We're called the sandwich generation. Sometimes. Yeah. And that switch for you probably helped bring you into what we call interdependence with your mother. You both depended on each other, which improves the equality between those two generations, your generation with your mother. And that's one of the tasks that Keniston is referring to, of creating a new relationship with your family of origin as you learn to take on the kinds of responsibilities they have. And be responsible to and for them. If they've done it right, one of my mentors here used to say that the point in parenting is to raise your children so that by the time they're adults, they can stand beside you as equals. And then I used to like to add to that, and so that later they can stand beside your hospital bed and make decisions for you that you will trust, because someday they may be doing that. My kids get the privilege of pulling the plug, and I want them to be responsible as they do that, decide when I kick off. It's an important responsibility for kids to have, and if you realize that your kids are going to have it, there's some things you want to teach them and make sure they've experienced. You don't want them to hate you when you're in a coma. So the responsibility angle is one way to address that question. Another way to address it is that you start off in a family of origin, the one you originate in, where you are had by the parents. And then you eventually loosen your ties to that one and make commitments in a new one that the sociologists call the family of procreation, the one where you are going to create the next generation, and your first priority becomes to children. And then some of us put in a third kind of family that we create sometimes in early adulthood, the family of affiliation, which is a group of people we choose to live with and be family with, even if we're not biologically related. And that one is becoming more important because many of us spend time in a family in adulthood at various points, a family that is not a family either of origin or procreation. I'm in one, in my second marriage. It's not my family of origin. I didn't grow up in it, and it's not my family of procreation, because we don't have children. So together we each have children, but we're from two different families of procreation. So it's a family that we choose to be in. And then later or at some points in life, other people create families of affiliation that are neither families of origin or families of procreation. People who live together, without being married, or they are married and them. There are all different kinds of variations of that. But it's an important family style that's crept into the literature on family over the last few years. We'll talk about that in 60. So those are some of the ways that relations with families change. There are probably half a dozen others as well. It's a complex question. I'm sorry? Yeah, if we put it on the exam, we'll definitely narrow it a little bit. Yeah. We'd better. Otherwise, you have to grade the question. That'll make sure that it gets narrowed. Any? What would you expect for essay questions?
Skip. Okay.
Might be something that would integrate all three domains, because we've got the one promised question that clearly requires that. You don't want to give me any ideas? Differentiation and integration would be a candidate, since we've used that. Do we use it both exams? Yeah. So an example of that in the psychosocial domain.
Could you give
me an idea? Here's an example. What would you like to... Where do you see differentiation and integration in the psychosocial domain? Okay, elaborate on that a bit. That's a... Mm-hmm. Okay, so thinking about... I'm sorry?
Like playing with Barbie.
Uh-huh. Okay, so looking at friendships, especially across childhood and adolescence, what would be the undifferentiated state? And again, it's always important when you think about differentiation to think about what is the undifferentiated state, and what's getting differentiated out of that. Maybe from all of your peers, sort of as a group, to differentiating particular kids that you do activities with. I can think of a specific differentiation that takes place in infancy and toddlerhood in the peer group, which is dividing kids into boys and girls. So that's a differentiation. And then that gets elaborated into segregation of boys from girls and vice versa in the peer group in the preschool. And then coming back together to put the different cultures that get created in the boys group and the girls group, putting them back together into a co-ed peer group in late childhood and adolescence. And being able to have friends of both sexes and activities that both participate in. So that would be a nice example. Sullivan's theory gives you more, because he says that we start off in the relationship with the caregiver, mother particularly, and then add relationships that are different. So that would be an example of differentiating other people, figuring out that they're different from mother. So you have father and other caregivers and siblings and all those. And developing differentiated ways of dealing with different kinds of people, so that you don't treat your teacher the way you treat your mother. You recognize the difference. but then being able to integrate a whole repertoire of relationships so that you can be in a conversation with a teacher and your mother and your best friend and speak appropriately to each one and keep them all separate so they're not all the same person. So ideally you do that all the time. You talk with different kinds of people and differentiate their roles and transact with them appropriately.
What about going and thinking and acting with emotion? Would that be something where you can't act with your emotion, but you can't differentiate those two, and then as you get older, you can bring yourself to higher and do things while you're trying to show emotion?
Yep, exactly. The whole notion of differentiation in Bowen's is a good example, because he's talking about the undifferentiated cognitive and emotional engines, and then eventually separating those and being able to deal with them both at the same time, which is the integration.
Would that be
psychosocial? Mm-hmm. Yeah. We started this unit. The question is, would that be psychosocial? We start with the emotions and the changes in emotional expression as sort of root concepts in the psychosocial domain. Because emotions and emotional regulation are involved in all of the relationships that you create, and attachment. I'm hungry. You're tired.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Good questions.